Life is dull, life is gray. At its best, it's just okay. But I'm happy to report, life is also short. So I find myself back in California.
Once again with Edie Meadoff, who is most recently the author of Lola, California. Edie, it's been 5 years. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm happy to be back in an old neighborhood in the West Village.
Yes. Well, last time we did sort of a tag team interview with Scott Esposito, and I can assure you that I'm slightly more coherent after 5 years, so hopefully we'll get some going. Now, when we last talked, I'm going to bring up that interview. You said that the first-person perspective was the most authentic method of getting the reader to believe in the account. Yet in Lola, California, we see something very interesting where it's a series of third-person perspectives, glimpses, sideways, sometimes direct to the characters. Did you pursue third-person because you were tired of the first-person voice of Emil in Crawl Space? I was reading Vic Mahler, and he reminded me very much, especially in those moments with Javier, of Emil, so it's kind of almost a vestige. But just to kind of get a jumping off point, what of this?
Wow, that's a great question. This is actually the first interview I'm doing about Lola.
Yes.
So you're honored. You're forcing me to think about that. You know, honestly, okay, I still hold by what I said before, which is probably some version of this, that in a stressed out age, the account that we can believe best is that of a first-person narrator who is as close as we can come to any simulacrum of truth. But a more natural way for the novelist in our panoramic age to perceive the world is that of the close third, where you can play more, you have more liberty to convey the act of realism where you're giving some version of the truth and yet you're not disguising the art of the perceiving author. And so there's a greater overall truth to it, and it's probably for me a more natural way to write.
Yeah.
So I just because the story was so so much like a panopticon, I wanted to do the shifting third. Closer.
More natural, how so? Because some writers fit into a first-person perspective, and it's like putting on a glove, you know?
How is
it more natural for you? I'm curious.
Because the book, anyway, is always an artifice and is always pretending to convey some kind of mimetic reality. So if I give you the third, you're still aware that I'm doing the kind of prestidigitation of the author, and yet sometimes my perspective merges with the character, so that one hopes it's like a glove. And at other times, the fact of the artifice is acknowledged.
Yeah. Well, I also want to talk about Vic Mahler as a sort of, if there was any residual influence from Emil, because when he's in the prison, he has that same kind of manipulative Machiavellian quality, and yet, at the same time, not. So I'm wondering about that in terms of, I'm always fascinated when authors discuss shaking off the yoke of a previous book. Was there anything along those lines with this, or?
I know, the question terrifies me.
It's no distinct entity.
I think, when you're asking it, I'm thinking Flaubert saying, you know, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. I feel part of me is Emil and is Victor.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for me to get into that head.
Yeah.
So it's probably my, I could very easily write, and in fact, I cut out endless pages from Vic's perspective.
Oh, wow.
I was really trying to write from a female perspective in this book. Yeah.
Did you start with the Vic perspective, or?
What was the first kernel of the book? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, exactly. Or was it the two young ladies?
It was 1 month after I'd given birth to my first daughter. I was living in Northern California, and I was struck by the loss of that prior self pre-motherhood. I hadn't quite figured on the whole, you know, immensity of motherhood. And I thought, you know, in American fiction at least, there's a huge chasm between, in the main, a kind of female realistic tradition and a male idea-oriented kind of fiction. And I had thought of having my first book come out under a pseudonym with my initials and masking my gender. I don't like that kind of deep gender divide. So in my head, I thought, I want to write a post-gendered fiction. I want to write something that also captures the sense of the doppelganger of that old childhood self that so quickly runs away once you become a parent.
Yeah. Do you think that this gender divide makes it more difficult for you as a woman writer to write and publish an ideas-driven novel, especially something like this one where you're dealing with a situation where the perspective of all these characters, it requires a lot of patience from a reader to get the supposed payoff only in this book to find additional stories and additional layers and additional strata of details where we realize, oh, wow, we actually don't know these characters in our initial desire to know, well, what did Vic Mahler do is usurped by this new inquiry to the characters of like, well, what was going on with his daughter or what's going on now with the spa many years later and the like. I mean, is this, first of all, a riskier proposition for you being a woman? And second of all, a riskier proposition in terms of, well, you have to have the reader go along for this ride, just irrespective of gender. I mean, how much do you consider the reader and how much do you consider this this issue you brought up earlier?
It's a good question. Okay, so there are about seven layers in your question. But
absolutely.
So, okay.
Well, you wrote a book with seven layers, so I figured that was fair.
Okay. So you're saying there's kind of a narrative striptease.
Yeah.
And that I do believe in that. I believe that's an. I believe fiction is the act of omission. And that unlike a poem or a painting where there's a simultaneous information, you know, kind of a frontal plane, I want to have that Hansel and Gretel trail to the bit of non. Okay, that said, I was thinking about this book. You know, there's. I'm going to answer you by the back door. Freud once said something about there being about five dreams. There's a dream you had. There's a dream as you recount it. There's a dream as an analyst remembers it later. There's, you know, et cetera. So what I like about this book, which is kind of an omnibus book, which does require certain patience and perseverance on the part of the reader, is that nonetheless, there's some way each reader is going to find a purchase point. It's not exclusively speaking to one kind of reader, although it does require somebody who's willing to go through a certain kind of sentence structure.
Yeah, I know that.
I tried to write this very accessibly.
Yes. Well, you mentioned also last time that you have a tendency to write the equivalent of three books for every one book, and I'm wondering, you know, how much this notion of rewarding the reader, whether through a little tidbit reveal about a character or even a short chapter, which we haven't even gotten to that, came from this absolutely manic way of overwriting and then just getting it down. As I remember, in an email to me, I'm going to use my sort of exclusive knowledge here, you said you were trying to get this thing down to like 250 pages at one point, and lo and behold, we have a 450-page book, so I have to ask, what happened there?
I know, what happened? I know, and my long-suffering, wonderful editor and agent who have... you know, I do try to only put in what I think is essential for the character's development. You know, this book reflects the prismatic nature of my time during the X number of years that I was writing it. So, you know, I noticed recently there's been a kind of spate of books. You know, Peter Orner wrote The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, or there are other books which now have this kind of episodic, prismatic quality. So again, you could say, is it because we have such a stressed out age, we believe our reader will only last, you know, until kind of mental commercial break? Or is reality itself just more fractured and we are really in this postmodernist moment of, you know, do we not believe the unitary narrative?
I didn't
plan to write it this way, but this seemed like the path of integrity for these characters.
Yeah. Well, it seems interesting in light of what Lynn Tillman once told me. She said that the reader has to earn the right after X number of pages to know more about the characters, much as how if we talk with someone after a certain amount of time, well, we get certain stories, we get the person's name, or in Lynn's case, the character's name. Was there a similar philosophy in place for Lola California, do you feel? Or?
Right, so you're saying, does the task-reward equation reading...
I mean, it sounds Pavlovian, it sounds regrettably television commercial-like, the metaphor you used, but, you know, on the other hand, does the reader get his carrot after a while, or was this a consideration when you were editing this book down? Or?
There is probably. You know, I do believe in that. Laura Mulvey has that idea of visual pleasure in cinema, and I try to do the equivalent in narrative. I'm sure I'm cannibalizing things we talked about way back.
Yeah.
But I do believe there's the two forces that drive a book are Eros and Thanatos. So that somehow you got to have those engines operating. It doesn't have to be in a pyrotechnic plot manner.
Yeah.
It can be within a character's own sort of condensed world where there might be a little form of a death or a little form of a kind of motivational urge. But you need to have Eros and Thanatos really thrumming along whole way.
That's true. But I will also confess to you that for the short chapters, especially since they came after the long chapters, I felt guilty for the fact that the pages were flowing as fast as they did. I said, wait a minute, I got used to a specific pace with these long, dense chapters. Denser. Sometimes detailing about 20 years of activity in one, 30-page chapter. And then all of a sudden it's zip, 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 zip. And then I think to myself, oh my God, am I missing something? Should it be moving this fast? Should I? And I would sometimes go back and read them again. And I'm curious... What was your strategy here? You know.
I love that you were having essentially a recursive process, like the way memory functions for the characters. That thrills me.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying deliberately to be so difficult in a formalist way, but I began in music in a way, and I believe just. As you have the robustness of music, you know, you have a little coda or you have a swelling orchestral section. I'm trying to do the equivalent in fiction.
Yeah. Is this a method also of staving off the sort of Dan Brown flip, flip, flip between... there are some people who read Dan Brown books between a commercial break, which I find to be not necessarily a sufficient experience, although I can also understand it as well. Is this kind of a way of subverting the present 21st century reader expectations that books need to zip along, or is this a way of also perhaps taking this idea of my books can zip along too, just as much as say like someone like Dan Brown?
Sometimes I feel the essential part of a scene can be, I am always trying to write in the sparest manner, even though it might seem hard to believe.
Yeah.
I'm not going into, you know, like David Foster Wallace's most recent work. I'm not going into maximalism for the sake of maximalism. I'm really doing it at the service of character, in my view of that.
Yeah. After you cut so many trees away, eventually...
There's nothing.
There is no maximalism.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about California. I'm wondering if there are certain advantages of writing about California without living there. The other question I have is, is this really a California novel? Because you have that episode with the mountain lion, right? And it's very reminiscent of, say, Jack London or something you might find in the T.C. Boyle book. And then we find a California that is entirely different from that. So, you know, what advantages, first and foremost, do you have writing away from a place? And second of all, can this really be called a California novel? Or?
Interesting. I love these multi-layered questions. You're doing the same thing I do, where I can just find a purchase point anywhere. I kind of do agree with Hemingway in A Movable Feast, where he says it's easier to write about a place when you're not in it.
Yeah.
That said, much of this novel was actually written in California. I mean, bits were written in California.
Yeah.
The seed was there. Every novel that I've written so far has been a kind of daisy chain with the novel before it. So even as I was beginning this, I was finishing up Crawl Space in a certain way.
Yeah. So there was some carryover between the two books.
In between editing Crawl Space, I was slowly beginning this. probably when we met, I was already beginning this book.
That may also explain some of the Vic Lawler carryover
as
well.
That's true. Yeah. Interesting. Good point. Although I may just keep on writing that same, you know, aged, jaundiced man in my whole life. You know, who knows? But he is loosely based on somebody, Norman O'Brown, who died maybe 8 years ago, who was this kind of visionary, you know, rumpled professor type who lived in Santa Cruz.
But to go back to the question of this being a California novel, how do you tap into the California spirit when you're not in California? Or do you have a deep repository of living that will allow the reflective exigencies of writing a novel?
You know, California does seem more and more absurd the more I go back to it and the more I've lived away from it. And that said, it is my home water.
Yeah.
I understand it so thoroughly. I will end up back in California. You know, it's the everything that is in the novel, you know, whether it's daring the elements, as you were saying, with the mountain lion, or, you know, the kind of body-centric nature of existence that so privileges health over, perhaps, at times, the life of the mind.
Yeah.
You know, the absolute apotheosis of that edict for self-improvement in every possible realm. You know, all these things that are so Californian, whether or not I want them, they're my birthright. I mean, I could no more be non-Californian than I could amputate my arm, you know?
Yeah. So, on the other hand,
does that answer your question?
It does, but I'm curious about the idea of seeing California as more cartoonish or more weirder or crazier. I mean, you know, one needs to look no further than the California budget crisis right now, where you have Jerry Brown popping back from the dead, vetoing the budget that his own party actually offers. It's absolutely absurd, the idea of closing down parks to save money. And then you think about it, and it's like, well, they're going to have to reopen the parks. Won't that cost the same amount of money to actually do the upkeep from the parks being closed over the year? It's absurd, but when you're living there, it actually makes a certain kind of sense.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if you can really live there when you're writing a novel, or whether the possibility of seeing it more as cartoonish might impair to some degree your ability to present California effectively in a novel.
Do you feel that there's been a Californian novel written by a living Californian?
I would say T.C. Boyle would definitely be up there. I would say
Joan Didion.
I would say that. I would say also A.B. Bender's last book, to my mind, is very much a Los Angeles novel, even though it only deals with Los Angeles in not complete terms or incomplete terms. It still captures the essence of what it is to... Dana Spiata, I would say, she writes Los Angeles novels. But I think that...
I love her writing.
Huh?
I'm a big fan of hers. I love her work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but I guess the question, though, and I'm just curious just from you, because there are so many Californias, I think, contained in this book, much as there are twins, much as there are people who have multiple names. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact that you have L.A. spelled out L.A., or you refer to what people often say is I-5 as Highway 5 or 5. Do you feel that because California can be identified by so many names that really, the issue I'm talking about, how can one effectively present California as writer Nolan Voight simply because California has so many identities? I know it's a huge question.
No,
but it's
huge. Okay, so I'm just going to refer you. I don't know if you saw. I wrote an article for The Millions about California.
I was going to bring that up, yeah.
Okay, so, but, you know, it addresses some of what you're talking about. I think the truth of California, if there's one truth, is that people secretly crave the crowded villages of the East Coast or the Midwest. There is always a craving for a tribe or community. So this idea of the endlessly shifting name is actually the other side of the strong hunger to be in a place where everyone has the same name.
Yeah.
And so the slipperiness of names has to do with that. You know, you don't have... you don't know the sandstone you're standing on, whether or not, what kind of history it has. So you claim, I am of the sandstone, and I am like this other person who's standing on this similar slippery sandstone.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about Daughter of California. Okay. You wrote that your father was ideally suited to California because California seems to listen but insists on rose-colored landscapes, which is very much the dilemma we're talking about, I think, here. It has the compelling charisma of a narcissist, one which lures emigrants out to fulfill internal narcissistic dictates. So I happened to reread this essay while I was reading Lola California, and I was struck by how Vic Mala's relationship with his daughter seems to become more exposed, more austere, more fulfilling of these internal narcissistic dictates when he is, in fact, in prison, which is very interesting. And it, less rose-colored, of course, when he is on trial. To what degree, I'm wondering, did you consider Vic Mahler's cell as a uniquely Californian one? And at the risk of some overly psychoanalytical reading, if Vic Mahler represented the way for you to come to terms with your father's relationship with California, how difficult was it to stray, as a matter of necessity, from this inherent truth? I know, lots.
No, I know. It's a wonderful question. I mean, it answers itself. Uh-huh. I mean, in a way, the cell as a uniquely Californian space, you know, I don't like to think necessarily in binaries, but the fact that he's alone in his cell contemplating the bad choice that led him there in this state that is all about the incredible fantasy land of choice. And yet the one overdetermined plane for him is his daughter in so many ways. So I like creating, kind of doing the art direction around my characters that will accentuate their character flaws and, you know, intensifying the pressure on them. So the character, as you said, I like that, you know, becomes the relationship over the course of the novel becomes more starkly defined. In a way, the prison cell, in one way, was created to show how ultimately we don't choose our families.
Yeah.
The lack of choice that it represents is there as a bas-relief for everything else that happens in the novel.
Yeah.
Does that answer?
It does, but I was curious about how Vic's cell was a Californian cell. Did you focus it as something that was a distinctly Californian cell? I mean, when you think about things like the three strikes, you're outlaw, when you think about sometimes the overcrowded prisons that are in California, I suppose a prison in California is California, definitely.
Yeah, it's an archetypal.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It represents the sins of the state. I mean, given that the, you know, and one of the things in my research that I found so fascinating, I don't know if this is in the book, maybe, it is somewhere, but, you know, that the states with the highest tradition of vigilante justice, where there wasn't the kind of, one of the things that I see on the East Coast is that there are very clear yardsticks, both of justice and aesthetics.
Yeah.
In California, with that huge geographic space, vigilante, localized justice prevails. And in a way, you know, the book is about vigilante, localized justice.
Yes, it is.
In a way.
Well, also, let's talk about the twins in this book. You've got Lana's twins, and you have Lana and Rose, both as twins. But I don't really want to reveal one of the book's twists, but it is interesting to me that the twins in this book, they all recall narcissists to some degree, first of all, going back to the internal narcissistic dictates we were talking about in relation to California. But all the twins are inherited in some way. Were there initial attempts in earlier drafts to have more innate twins? Or were you thinking about narcissism as a kind of arranged set? You were talking earlier about how California, well, we find other people like this, but I was curious about this.
Well, you know, I've always been fascinated by twins, and I was reading recently Joyce Carol Oates has the same obsession, and I mean, I have a feeling that most people who are deeply involved with literature are reading to find twinship, really. I mean, because you're there in your isolated chamber and you're reading and you're seeking union with some other soul. So I wanted, as much as there's a kind of polyglot sensibility both in the structuring of the book and in its content, You know, the idea of having a twin with whom you have a true language. You know, the language that is not necessarily passed on over generation, but that one, you know, in the tradition of California self-creates. You know, I like the idea of, as you say, that's a nice paradox to me, inherited twinship.
But for Lana's twins, you have, interestingly enough, this robot who's attempting to mediate their relationship to California to a large degree, which, if you look at twins generationally, that's both a funny joke and also a frightening possibility, almost the suggestion, at the risk of offering my own interpretation, that the way that twins, whether those who come out of the gate as twins or those who find others, the only way they can seem to relate is through some mechanized medium that is also simultaneously being used as a way of offering storytelling. In this case, there are some really regrettable results because of that. But I'm curious how this robot, Lestier, developed.
Well, I mean, one of the themes of the novel has to do with the shirking of personal responsibility that's also encoded in the state's unwritten mandate. And, that the twins, or, well, one of them, kind of extrajects authority out into this robot, an agency. And that this robot, as you said nicely, you know, the robot's mediating ethics. I mean, what else, you know, you just brought up the kind of terrible state of the whole collectivity of California, which is, you know, it always is running into this dilemma, you know, how you have personal fulfillment butting up against any idea of collectivity. Every problem that the state has to do with that. And so the robot as a kind of, you know, in the same way that in Crawl Space, Emil had a little pendulum to help him justify his decisions. I like the idea of having a palpable talisman for somebody shirking.
Yeah. What steps did you take to sort of consider the robot? I mean, did you investigate robots? Did you research robots very carefully or just kind of imagine?
I just imagined it. I you know, I grew up as a tomboy. I had an older brother.
Yeah.
And I love this. I was privy to a lot of that secret language of boys, and I just kind of came out of me and I thought, how can I make this fit with this novel?
Yeah. Dirk, the California native in this book, who comes from Truckee, he has to escape what you describe as the town's city-country microcosm. One that transforms dwellers into lifers by locating the noblesse oblige of high ideals. Now, you've presented a lot of California natives who feel the need to migrate or escape their origins once they have obtained enlightenment, which nicely mirrors what's going on with Vic Mahler's philosophy. Later in the book, you have Dirk. He lays his hands on both of Lana's ankles in healing supplication, all before checking his watch and going on to the next meeting. Now, I have to ask, this is a very curious, tactile form of enlightenment, but I'm wondering, can't enlightenment also be found by embracing your origins and staying put and avoiding these Mensa types who run spas? Was the idea here to suggest that your characters are encountering this false set of high ideals and perhaps these ideals that heal in the case of the ankles? Is this a unique California proposition? Or?
Can I just, first of all, hire you to read at any of my readings? You read that so well. Really, sincerely.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, well, in answer, you know, it always struck me when I was growing up how most of the adults I knew were getting very fetishistic about these kind of incremental step-like stages they had to take toward enlightenment or their own salvation. I used to think, why couldn't a housewife pushing a vacuum cleaner around just have, you know, in the next second her own enlightenment? What is this idea of deferring, you know, the teleology of deferment?
Yes.
So on the one hand, in California, you know, have the pleasure, you know, have your goat cheese on baguette right now.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, oh, I am on a path. Yeah. I'm on the path. It's far away, and I know the steps, at least in the tribe I am in now. And, you know, the paradox confounded me because people get so married to the means of enlightenment or, you know, self-perfection that they don't necessarily see the grace of the present moment.
Yeah.
And it strikes me as really like the apotheosis of Calvinism. I mean, it is, you know, if I work hard, grace will visit me, but it won't just come right now. I have to work hard. It's a fulfillment of the American dream.
The thing with Dirk that really gets me is that he can't just stay in Truckee or any particular position in once obtaining the enlightenment. Okay, I know how to go about doing my business. I more or less, I've obtained this confidence to see the world for what it is, but I could also have this humility and go about it. That to me was really interesting, that a lot of the characters in this book just are constantly escaping enlightenment and constantly unable to just put their hunches down and just, hey, shut up and deal, you know what I mean?
Right, because that's the burden of the California dream, this endless horizon of endless choice that... Yeah. You can't be in your small New England town and say, okay, this is my lawn and flag, and I gotta accept the leopard's not gonna change its spots. You know, my neighbor is the way she is, she's not gonna change. Or, you know, this way people in crowded places have to deal with one another.
Yeah, it's sort of like the many burrito metaphors in this book, which there's someone who speaks in the tone of not getting the burritos.
Right.
I like that quite a bit. And then I noticed, like, two more burritos pop up throughout the book. You're basically saying that one's relationship to California is comparable to a burrito? Or were you just missing the burritos as much as I do from the Mission District?
I think it's a symbol, though, of that consumer choice. It's the kind of the emblem of California. You know, it's vaguely ethnic. It's been neutered. People hanker for it in very specific ways.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, burritos were invented by cowboys. So it's interesting how it was appropriated culturally, and yet it's also sort of associated with California as well. So, okay.
Yeah.
The most frequent substitute for she said in this book is she lied, yet the reader is going to want truth. You know, what of the nature of lies, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about in terms of why you employed third-person perspective here, but... does exploring or thinking about California like this cause both reader and author, you're going to be reduced to a pack of lies at the very end because everybody's always on the run from enlightenment?
Next time, can I have you be the editor of my book? I love that. you know, but what I would say is by saying she lied, this may be a kind of post-facto justification, but that it invites the reader into the iron. You know, I do think meaning comes from doubleness. And if you have 2 points, whether it's 2 points in time or 2 points of perception rubbing up against each other, there you have richness. There's meaning. And so to say she lied, already you're in a kind of troika. You're being invited into the dance. You're complicit. You have a little greater intimacy.
Yes.
So that was probably the crutch I was using.
I want to ask about the dramatic appeal of the trial. There was a trial in the last book, sort of, and there was a trial in this book, sort of. What of the trial? I mean, it's the ultimate way to force a character to become contrite with what they have done, with their ultimate sin. But I don't know. I'm looking at you now, and I see the possible courtroom junkie quality. I don't know. What of courtroom trials? Do you think that today's novels and dramatizations seem to have gone away from this basic justice? I mean, why trials?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in a way, I hear what you're saying. You're saying, am I kind of creating a hysterical version of what is actually, it could be a kitchen, you know, ethical confrontation, rather than making it confront one of the institutions of society. You know, I have not being somebody who has spent a lot of time in the, you know, in any way linked to the law, I think I like playing, and maybe I'll try to tone it down in the next book, but I like playing with society's institutions, you know, the prison, the courtroom. In this book, there's also a sanitarium. I mean,
yes, of course.
You know, the spa.
Yeah.
I think it interests me, I guess, especially when you have such an ectoplasmic subject as California, it's interesting to have a hard-edged setting in which somebody comes into, you know, a kind of dark mirror moment. That said, you know, one of my favorite scenes in literature is in Madame Bovary, to go back to Flaubert. I love this scene, but this is kind of a societal institution too, where you have the there's a kind of village marketplace, like a pig contest, a kind of very agricultural contest taking place. And up above, you have the two lovers having this intimate scene. And it's interspersed with this judging of the pigs. And I love that interleaving of the very small and personal against the bigger, habitual, unseeing eye of society.
Yeah.
So maybe that's an answer.
Or maybe it's a way of turning something that is seemingly individual or personal into something that means, that has the resonance of history. If you align a personal strength or a failing with an institution, suddenly, yes, there is the societal impression. There is this sense that everything we do will matter more if it's being judged by a jury.
Yeah, no, that said, but I mean, I do also deeply believe in this Wordsworth idea that in the meanest flower, a universal wind blows. So I am hearing it. I'm thinking, okay, maybe in the next book I'm going to avoid all big scenes. You know, I'm going to keep it smaller. No personal. But, you know, no, I mean, maybe I'm starting to lean on that as a crutch.
I don't know, though. I mean, you're going to inherently repeat certain elements over several books, but approaching it from a different angle, it's going to become fresh. Like, there's one really great early moment where there's stealing slices of pizza from a parlor that, you know, if you think about it, if you want to reduce it down to its basic essence, well, it's common shoplifting, it's a common theft, but because of the way you describe it, it actually means something and it resonates. And I don't know if avoiding, say, a trial or avoiding a specific element in a future book is
right.
Really an honest approach if you're writing fiction.
That's true.
You think?
When you said that, I suddenly had this view of fiction, like the mosquito eye with all its little parts.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe just you rotate it, the element means something different. So perhaps.
Yeah. Huh. So, on the other hand, you have to be extremely reliant upon the subconscious in order to write fiction. You have to completely capitulate to the muse, so to speak, and not be aware of conscious repetition, conscious things you may have been employing in previous books and the like. And what do you do to deal with this? Do you think that the whole enormous operation of honing a book pretty much negates any concern for oh, I've done this before. Oh my God, Ed has noticed this from a previous book or something like this. I mean, you know, to what degree should it even matter?
Do you think it's a truism that most writers essentially write and rewrite the same book over and over and just get better at it? Until they
to
are not
some
better.
Degree, I believe that. And it all depends on the voice, and it all depends on the ambition. I mean, some writers write the same book, if you boil it down to its basic elements, even though every book will be different. I think once you strive to not do that, and I think that the best way to do that is just to simply approach something, perhaps as you have, an enormous mosaic of institutions with which to splay the typical into something that is a little bit more distinct, you think?
You know, it's possible. Just thinking about, you know, the certain writers I admire, you know, I'm thinking of Saul Bellow or others who, you know, work against a societal backdrop or, you know, J.M. Coetzee, you know. But there's a way that even if their elements are identifiably repeated, each book, they're really in a different timbre.
Yeah.
And or this is also true, actually, in a way of Alice Munro, even though her turf is a different turf.
Yeah.
You know, and we're sitting in this restaurant maybe two blocks away from where years ago I interviewed this woman who each year, her name was Linda Montano, she was a performance artist. Each year she would wear a different color. And that was her art.
Huh, yeah.
And she would have people come here to bring out different energies. And you know, it is probably, it's a question of focus. You know, one probably brings the same understanding of what literature is meant to do to each novel. But there's a, you know, I was trying to work with, to use Linda Montano's words, a different chakra for this book.
Or maybe it's that ambition that causes difference. I mean, okay, I love P.G. Wodehouse like you wouldn't believe, but he does have a tendency to repeat some of his basic elements. But you know what? at the same time, I don't care because it's just very delightful. His sentences are so rhythmic. There's a great sense of fun. There's a great sense of quirkiness. Same thing goes for like a lot of comic novelists. You can John P. Marquand, the great undersun guy who won the Pulitzer and now nobody reads, or Don Levy, for example, who I read for the first time this year. The Ginger Man was incredible. Then I read his next book. I'm like, wait, this is the same thing as the last one.
You know what I'm thinking as you're talking? Maybe each author over his or her lifetime is creating kind of rules of counterpoint, aesthetic counterpoint. And within that, there's greater potential, you know, tension. Yeah. In other words, if you know the furniture is there, maybe you can create different kind of energy, a heightened energy, once you've established this is the furniture of my craft.
Yeah. So do you think that it's a matter of every author creating as many furniture options as possible so there's the illusion that the author is not repeating herself? Or?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. I mean, that sounds so modular.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it doesn't work that way. It's not like a desktop theme or anything. But
no, but I mean, wouldn't you say this is true that most artists over their lifetime are refining their understanding of the medium? You know, they're refining what... This is an element I consider absolutely necessary, and I'm going to do this with as few strokes as possible now that I understand what this is. Every artist becomes less and less Baroque as he or she ages. Picasso, Coetzee, I mean, so many artists become simpler.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe, you know, so ultimately the true enlightenment for the novelist would be a one-word novel that says love or pain. But, you know, some version of that.
Well, let me ask you, Edie, have the novels become simpler or...
No.
I mean,
no.
You know, yeah.
I mean, I think I'm always aiming... People are always shocked that I love Coetzee because he's so bare. Yeah. I am aiming to write a very bare novel.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
So I think the minimalists are my corrective.
Okay. Well, that seems a very interesting way out. But, Edie, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was a pleasure, too.
Bye-bye.